The gun dealer said, well, I'll keep him here while you come and get him. And they said, sorry, that's not a crime. If you sell him the gun, we'll come and arrest him and arrest you because you sold one to a prohibited person. But we would like to have a do something about the straw sales where a prohibited person has a associate, a wife, girlfriend, or whatever, go buy a gun for him. We'd like to be able to get both of them. I believe that's one of the things law enforcement.
Oh, so it's more than so.
Yeah. Well, another section. As this is just specifically the individual himself trying to buy, but we also have elsewhere in the bill knowingly buying for a prohibited person. So I'm probably getting ahead of myself.
Excuse me, Senator Springer.
Well, this is a question to counsel or to the proponents. Proving that somebody knew something is pretty tough to do beyond a reasonable doubt. Obviously, you have to rely upon circumstantial evidence or an admission. Is that basically the only way we can get at this in terms of the scienter that's required?
May I respond to that? We're fortunate in that, or unfortunate in that, in terms of filling out these forms, a person is going to be re-advised as to what the restrictions are on purchasing a firearm, and they're going to sign it. That they haven't been prohibited under all those prohibitions, and if someone signs that, they will have committed the act, and the knowledge portion will have been taken care of. Even on the long guns, for the time being, as part of the study, they'll have filled out that form that shows whether or not they're prohibited.
Thank you.
Jack?
Any further comment?
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, also, when a person is released from the penitentiary, placed on temporary release, go through any one of those exit procedures, they are also advised that they cannot purchase a handgun. So at least for that population of persons that have been convicted of a crime, they are also advised that they cannot attempt to purchase a gun. So you pick up a group there as well.
Okay, and if
that comment was raised, though.
Yeah, if you had proved that at trial, is there any documentation? Did you have to put in the person that did the screening and they say, I advise this person?
Yeah, there are forms that have to be signed by the person prior to release that has that information in them.
Jack?
Does this create somewhat of an anomaly in that if the person is successful in purchasing the firearm, and so it's no longer an attempt but rather possession, it's only an A misdemeanor rather than the C felony for attempting to buy?
Well, this section was, this is Corey from the Speaker's office.
I can't hear you, I'm sorry.
Corey McGregor from the Speaker's office. This section was specifically asked for, this language, by the NRA. They were real adamant about hitting hard the prohibited person who goes in and tries to buy.
I understand that, but my question is, if the store clerk isn't on top of things and the guy is actually successful, so it's no longer an attempt, it then becomes an A misdemeanor because it's possession, right? Does that seem like,
I suppose one, may I respond?
Yes, please.
One reason that you'd have a lesser sanction on possession is that there are a lot of people out there right now who may think that they're lawfully possessing firearms, and they may move at some point into those who are unlawfully possessing firearms, whereas in the attempt to purchase, they're going to have to go on through a procedure where just before the purchase was attempted, they signed off on a document which confirmed that there is no way, as long as they can read and write English, that there was any reason why they should have been able to do that. So that it's a more aggressive attempt by the person to break the law than the person who may simply have had in their possession a firearm.
Madam Chair, Council, I think the other scenario that's encompassed there has to do with persons who may be given firearms or who don't purchase them but who get them legally in other ways. And who don't have to go through all the procedures of filling out the forms and all of that. And so there is a distinction there as well. I'm not saying it's logical, but there are different ways to obtain guns. And
there may be a request that forms be prepared in Spanish. Federal forms are available in Spanish, but we don't address that in this bill.
I actually anticipated those distinctions, but nevertheless, if the person is successful, it goes from an attempt to a completed substantive crime, and we have the anomaly of it being subject to a lowered penalty.
Well, actually, if I can respond to that, you'll be subject to two penalties, because attempting to purchase was one crime, and once you've completed the purchase, if you maintain possession for more than a short, I assume that a court would make the distinction that short-term possession right after the purchase is part of that first crime, but then if you maintain your possession, you've committed a separate crime of maintaining a possession. There's going to be some time frame. It's going to be more than a few minutes, maybe days. I don't know how long a judge would say you should draw the line, but making the attempt to purchase, we're really trying to make it so that people who aren't supposed to purchase firearms don't even make the effort. On the other hand, there's still this concern that there may be semi-innocents abroad who are possessing them and lesser sanctions are imposed. It's a policy issue you might want to address, though. You may want to say that that should be a lesser crime. But that was the rationale for the distinction.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Section 16. Okay. I guess Section 16 is... I think anybody wants to talk about that?
John? You keep a register if you're selling, if you're in the business of selling used firearms, you keep a register.
Okay.
You're in charge. No, I'm not in charge. Corey's in charge.
Let me.
Section 17.
Just quick clarification. We say the person is a drug dealer, retail dealer, pawnbroker, or otherwise. Or otherwise, I guess could cover drug dealers. But are we talking about, you know, the firearm fairs or, you know, I know that there are conventions of these people who do this, but not in a commercial sense. Would anybody, when it says or otherwise, but I guess we're saying engage in the business as defined, so it would not apply to the swap meet or trades or, okay.
In fact, we deliberately wanted to focus on that. And by the way, right now it's illegal in Oregon. I might be corrected on this, I may be overbroad, but apparently it's illegal to individually sell firearms.
166-440.
In Oregon.
Handguns.
In Oregon. If you don't have a license.
Surprise
a lot of people to find out that that's on the books.
Madam Chair, Senator Springer, the reference to 18 U.S. Code, I finally found it. As defined by the Federals, a firearms dealer is defined as a person who devotes time, attention, and labor to dealing in firearms as a regular course of trade or business with the principal objective of livelihood and profit through repetitive purchase and resale of firearms. But such terms shall not include a person who makes occasional sales, exchanges, or purchases of firearms for the enhancement of a personal collection or a hobby, or who sells all or part of his personal collection of firearms. And that's the reference to U.S. Code.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, that's good. Okay. Here we get to Section 17. What is it now to do that? Is that, or is it not a crime? Or what? How does that fit? Is that just a restatement of what we have now?
I believe that's new language.
New law.
It's a new crime.
It's new, yeah. Any questions about that part?
Yes, Madam Chair. Is there something comparable to this? Is this an unusual provision? I mean, I guess I'm in trying to prove that someone sold a firearm knowing that it was going to be used for to commit a crime.
My recollection was that, may I?
Sure, please.
Was that one of the reasons this arose was that there are criminals who make it a part of their criminal trade to loan or rent firearms to other criminals for a day or for a couple of days for a particular robbery or whatever. It sounded incredible when I heard the testimony, but it's true. There is a business out there of providing firearms to other criminals, and this is one way of attacking that problem. There will have to be there's a pretty tough standard of proof, because you're going to have to show knowledge or reasonable cause to believe that a felony will be committed with a firearm. So it's not just a misdemeanor. You've got to know or reasonably know that someone's going to commit a felony. But if that can be proven, then in effect you're really aiding and abetting somebody in a crime anyway, and we're saying that it's going to be an intermediate felony, which is a Class B felony, trying to sort of split the difference between Class A and Class C.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, a couple of years ago, the interagency task force from FBI, Drug Enforcement, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, a couple of other federal agencies raided nationwide a group of motorcycle gang known as the Bandidos. They served the warrants at 8 o'clock on the East Coast, 5 o'clock on the West Coast, and the intermediate. They got one underground dealer up in the state of Washington, up out of Bellingham, and the guy was an ex-con with a record going back to his teens, absolutely prohibited to own a firearm. He was running a gun shop, unlicensed gun shop, out of his basement, containing mostly stolen firearms, including a lot out of Fort Lewis. But he had over 500 guns in stock, which he was selling to anybody who would walk in and pay the money with no records, no nothing. Over 150 of those were fully automatic weapons, which are illegal in the state of Washington, and in either smuggled in from Canada or stolen out of Fort Lewis. There is a big underground criminal market out there in illegal guns, and we're attempting to stop the illegal dealer.
Okay, so you're not concerned then that somebody, I guess the person you'd maybe be concerned about is someone who's not, I understand that type of person would be covered, but suppose, for example, I sell my firearm to someone and then they subsequently commit a crime with it. You'd have to prove that I knew that they were going to. Okay.
That you knew or reasonably should have known from the circumstances that they were going to commit not just a crime, but a felony. It's pretty limited.
Counsel. Representative Manz, I think you may have just answered my question. Was this language, I don't know what reasonable cause to believe means. Would it be your intent that would read reasonably should know? Or is reasonable cause a substitute for probable cause?
No, a reasonably should know would also fit in. The idea is that a reasonable person in those circumstances, knowing those facts, would understand that the purpose of the transaction was to use the, and it's a felony will be committed with the firearm, by the way. There's additive language to it, that this firearm is going to be used to commit a felony.
I might remind the committee that this is the term that we changed to make consistent in one of the wiretap bills.
Reasonably should know.
In that case, it was being used as as a substitute for probable cause, and we changed it to probable cause to make it consistent throughout the statutes.
We would have no difficulty with that kind of change. I don't know, I'm using the collective we, I'm assuming nobody else would. But I don't think from our committee's perspective, that we hadn't focused on that particular choice of words as one way or another. And the intent would be the same.
Up by the federal statute or something.
I suppose I should add a caveat. I'm in sort of an unusual situation. I'm one of five members of a subcommittee of the full Judiciary Committee that dealt with this bill. But they're one of the three members who voted the bill out of the subcommittee. And I'm one of the co-sponsors, and I was one of the carriers. But I'm not in any particular situation to use the kingly we when I'm talking about this. I hope you'll understand that. But I think I have a sense for what was being dealt with in the House, at least, and I can at least present that to the Senate.
Go ahead.
Were we running through this before where we were mentioning sections and giving overviews? I'll let Corey keep doing that, and I'll just chime in when questions arise, if that's all right.
Go ahead.
Section 18 is the enhancement section and sets up the minimum penalty. That's a change of 5 years if you use a firearm for a felony, if it's part of the crime. And it sets up additional penalties if you use a machine gun or this other class of, I think it's called Title II firearms in crimes.
Couple of questions.
Yes, Senator Shoemaker.
Sub 1, the definition of firearm doesn't conform to the amended definition that you have in Section 1. I don't know whether Legislative Council picks that up automatically or not. If they're both in the same bill, they might not.
I think that was an intentionally narrower definition for purposes of that one section, because the original definition of firearm was a weapon by whatever name known, designed to expel a projectile by the action of smokeless powder, leaving out black powder. So we deliberately excluded black powder guns from the bill generally, but when it came to using a weapon in a crime, we went back to re-include black powder guns. And that's why black powder is back in there for that one section alone, because walking in there with your single-shot musket is still, in effect, you're threatening violence on somebody. You're using a firearm. And we were trying, in one area we talked about excluding antiques. Generally speaking, we weren't worried about someone using a musket, which usually has to be loaded from at the tip of the front of the barrel, and you have to use the ramrod and all that. But if you walked into a bank with one of those, it'd be just as threatening to the teller as if you walked in with a handgun. So for purposes of enhancement, we brought back in the black powder weapon. Excuse me, I shouldn't use enhancement here for minimum terms.
Okay. Good explanation. Another question. Sub 3 provides that, and I guess it's existing law, but these sentences are not cannot be released or reduced or parole granted or anything of that sort. So they're absolute sentences.
Oh, no, no.
Not under present law, Senator.
No, look at sub 5.
All right, good point. My question was how this fits in with sentencing guidelines, assuming, of course, for the moment that we do end up the session with sentencing guidelines that are realistic. How does this play with that?
I'll answer it two ways. First of all, I think you'll find that the House will be very pliable in dealing with you on sentencing guidelines. We had to deal with certain political realities in getting a bill off the floor or even out of committee, and there are some things that the House has put into sentencing guidelines that I'm sure will be removed, and other things that may well need to be reduced in terms of what the House did, although some of those things that the House did were also recommended by the Commission. But getting back to this, it's also something that might be considered in terms of, instead of talking about minimum terms, and this is something the NRA will have to address with the Rifle and Pistol Association, I would get back to my slip of the tongue before and talk about enhancement or an aggravating factor. And if you want to tie in the sentencing guideline concepts here, I think when these bills are being worked on, it wasn't clear whether one or the other was getting through anywhere. And it's possible to build in the sentencing guidelines concepts in this section.
Okay. I think clearly you'd still have to... So far, this is the most difficult part for me to deal with because we have, it's a major change which will may or may not add to, and to include it as an aggravating factor is one thing, but to take away any option to deal with the release of the minimum would be, I think, my question is, did you get a reading on this part from the Criminal Justice Council as to the actual, if you had a permit, and could you share that with us, I guess, would be...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I also wanted to address another issue that was raised. It was our understanding upon making inquiry to the council and the State Sentencing Guidelines Board that, in fact, it was their intent to retain the gun minimums that are established in law, that are currently there.
Well, I understand that, but that also means that they need to retain sub 5, and if we change sub 5, the current statute would be changed for them as well, and I guess that my basic question is then...
Oh, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that was not the impression that we had gotten from the council, and that when reading this, they felt that the outcome would be the same. They did not feel that what the committee did would significantly impact in this section.
Except Senator Cohen is pointing out Section 5, which is the opportunity on a first offender to back off.
No, I understand that, but in the testimony that was provided and the information that I got from Catherine Ashford and the statistics that they had, they felt that the way that this bill currently reads and the way that sentences are currently being provided under this bill would come out, I mean, under current law, even with subsection 5 in, would come out almost the same. Sure. And they did not raise any eyebrows when they saw this.
Senator Cohen?
I just need to understand what's in when you say even with sub 5 in.
They didn't feel that in the information that they had on how 161.610 was being currently used,
which is not very often, actually.
That the provision in sub 5, which is to say you can ignore the minimums if you wanted to, was not being used, and felt that the impact as this was written would be the same as the impact is currently.
Okay, we'll need to check that out.
And would not increase bed space. It was a discussion that we did have, and that issue was raised.
If I could put it another way, the few times a prosecutor bothers to charge under the current version, it's such an egregious situation that no judge would want to give the criminal a break anyway.
They wouldn't do it anyway.
And if it might well, but I would hate to read the horror story that will come down the pike at some point of someone being forced into a 5-year prison sentence where actually you would want the judge to have an opportunity to exercise judicial discretion. I have to tell you honestly, although I may be one of the Ayatollah types on the House Judiciary Committee, I too believe that the judges have to, that's just a little joke, an inside joke actually, that judges do need to be given a certain amount of discretion. And this was put in there and sort of left in there without any heavy-duty debate, mainly because to put it bluntly, the NRA has been taking a position nationally. What you really need are minimum terms for people using firearms when they commit crimes. And there was not, as I can recall, a lot of heavy debate on that issue, and so we just let it slip into the bill.
Okay. Thank you. We'll take a look at that. Jack?
Because this bill creates essentially some new types of crimes of possession and that type of thing, raises an issue that I think is an issue under current law, and I'm not sure how, if it's been resolved in the case law or not, but I've heard of instances where prosecutors have threatened to use the gun minimum, for instance, in a felony ex-con possession case. Their argument being that the language up on lines 8 and 9, defendant's use or threatened use, includes mere possession. Now, from Representative Mannix's comments, I gather that that's not intended here, and that actually before a mandatory minimum can be charged, that you're intending it, that it actually be used in the sense of the word of a substantive crime?
No, I when I talk about egregious situations, I thought they may well threaten, and they may well plea bargain in a lot of those. We were just remarking on the fact that statistically there weren't a lot of people sentenced under this provision. But that doesn't mean a lot of threats weren't made about people being charged under this. And again, our friends who dealt with sentencing guidelines can probably help a little bit more about the statistics that they put together on that. But threatened use of a firearm is there, and the question is, my own feeling would be that I have no problem with giving the judge the discretion to back off, which is what that section that's being taken out. And that's just a personal statement.
I didn't make my question wasn't clear at all. I apologize. What I'm asking you is, when it says defendant's use or threatened use, do you or do you not intend that to cover mere felony possession? Okay. Does so in the felony possession crimes that we're creating, for mere possession, you're saying that a mandatory minimum sentence could be imposed?
You're carrying it? Yes. mere possession and carrying out a crime and you're carrying a weapon. Counsel's disagreeing. Let's hear it.
I'm not talking about carrying out another crime. I'm talking about strictly just pure and simple possession.
Because of the crime involved as a gun crime. If you've created a crime of illegal possession of a gun, you have then created a gun crime under this part, this old law. And that's the counsel's question, I think. You know, what is your intention? And if so, how do we clarify it to make it sure what the intention is? That a violation of the gun stat is mere is possession under the
that
new
as I read it. No, we're talking two separate things here. Then I was talking about the situation where you're packing a rod, packing a gun, or you wave it around, or you use it during the commission of a crime, some separate crime,
other than possession,
other than simply having it in your possession. Not it's not meant to be a bootstrap provision.
Pardon me?
It's not meant to be a bootstrap provision where you can automatically bootstrap all ex-cons into having a higher minimum penalty. That's not the intent.
Okay, anything else? I guess I should ask the question, the NRA in terms of the minimum terms on this sub 5, how important is that? Is that a breaking point on the bill? I mean, we've covered some of them. I just want to, for the record, let our committee know where you think the breaking point is.
Madam Chair, John Nichols, I don't think that would be a breaking point with them. It's a policy to sit, position on their part that minimum sentences deter crime and that people who misuse guns should go to jail and stay there. I don't think they'd back off the bill on if that were removed.
Senator Cohen?
Yes.
I'd like to respectfully suggest that one thing that could be done with sentencing guidelines down the pike here is to build this in as an aggravating factor to enhance the penalty a couple of levels for any time that a weapon is used.
Pardon me? It already is?
Oh, it is, and I think it's taken care of in sentencing guidelines. I don't have any problem with that. But if you change the existing gun statute in this bill, then you do affect there because they do referencing, and that's my concern. You know that if you take away the option for the judge to not charge a gun minimum, and look at some other aggravating circumstances, then we are throwing that in above and beyond or in addition to sort of aggravating, and I think it could upset the scheme. That's my question, and we'll find out. But I just want to know how important, you know, how important it is to the folks who've been at this table, and so we know what we're going to decide to go back to the original statute and reference the gun bill in that way.
Madam Chair, I think the record should reflect that the House Committee did consider that issue. The Council did testify on that issue during the course of our hearings.
I must have been out of the room.
We were paying attention.
Yes, please. Any questions? Any further questions on that?
Sections 19 and 20 were deleted by amendment. Section 21 and 22, the changes here are referencing changes. I don't believe there's anything terribly exciting there. And Section 23 also incorporates the definitions established.
Senator Shoemaker. The deletions that are found in Section 21 and 21 is. Are those of substance, or are those just because they're handled elsewhere?
Those sections are being replaced by this bill, Senator.
Okay. Thank you.
And Section 23 includes the definitions established earlier and previously in the bill.
Section 23 is the manufacturer, right?
Right.
Imports, manufacturers. Okay.
Passes.
Questions on Section 23?
I think so. 23 is the importing, manufacturing. 24 is intentionally altering. Anybody, Jack?
No.
Anybody else? 24 is what
well,
you can
I do have
oh, question. Jack has a question.
So this, it's a Class B felony for illegal possession of a handgun? Contrasted with the A misdemeanor for that we had just a moment ago.
For manufacturing.
For manufacturing.
Yes.
Manufacturing or causes to be manufactured.
Keeps, offers, exposes, gives, lends, or possesses.
But it says possesses too, so I don't. That's a straight possession there.
That's an oversight.
I mean.
That's an oversight. Because we have a separate sanction for possession, and it was meant to be. Those who are manufacturing and carrying on some sort of dealings. The trial court has general jurisdiction. But they would already have jurisdiction.
They would have jurisdiction, but the lesser courts need to be granted jurisdiction. Okay.
Section 36, as you mentioned, is the new language to the civil commitment statutes. This would be, in the way that the bill is currently written, this would, these criteria would obviously be in place, would be utilized subsequent to the effective date of the act.
I could explain that. That was a compromise worked out because of the concern about, what do you do with these civil commitments? Are you going to assume that because someone is civilly committed that they are incapacitated from having a firearm? And we finally came around to the notion that a judge should simply ask that question every time. From the evidence that I've seen in this case, should I make a notation that this person shouldn't be, have access to firearms? They've had a chance to present whatever case they've wanted. The judge is in the best position to make notation of that at the time of the decision. And that that way we avoided going back and reviewing a decision, trying to determine whether or not that's the way it should have been interpreted. So we left it in the hands of the person most involved in the decision making in a given commitment proceeding.
Okay, let's move on to Representative Calhoun, since I think we've got, well, we've got the big Section 38, I guess. It's,
yes, I was going to suggest that the committee look at Section 38,
which is the, and I assume that that is a.
I'll have, Madam Chair, before we
Senator
begin,
Gritsky.
I'll have to apologize to the committee. I ran into Representative Calhoun in the hall and made the mistake of mentioning that we had this bill in front of the committee. for that.
You should.
I think he would, yes. He knows where this bill is.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. There are a number of little things that I would hope to get to, but because of the time in the session, I may not have the chance. There's basically one large amendment or one large problem that I still see with the bill, and I voted for the bill out of the House because I think it was a real good faith effort, and most of the problems that were still in the bill when it left my subcommittee were fixed. The definition for, well, it's kind of, there's two parts to it. The first part are people that are on pretrial release from offenses, and the second part would be the definition of misdemeanors involving violence. My concern is that we try to adopt a federal definition, which I don't believe applies to possession. It only applies to purchases of firearms, first of all, and secondly, I don't think it's used very much, so nobody ever pays much attention to it. The definition could create some problems in a situation, not so much of concealed weapon permits, because a person would be able to go into it and apply for the permit. They'd find out there was a problem, they'd be able to ask for relief from that and go through a little more legal process and get around it. Same thing with purchasing a handgun. But in the situation of possession, is on line, or page 17, beginning at line 15 of the bill, it would create a problem because a person might receive some kind of a conviction for harassment. They'd be out hunting one day. There's no requirement that a police officer have any reasonable suspicion that any crime has been committed to check for a hunting license. They might run that through the criminal rap sheet or somehow know this person has a conviction for harassment. and bang, out of the blue, this person's basically on an ex-con in possession charge, or equivalent to that, and it's a misdemeanor in possession charge, and they would be arrested and so forth, and after the fact we would try to figure out whether or not that's a misdemeanor involving violence. I think in order to, if this section is going to be allowed or left in the bill, it might be limited only to A misdemeanors, or at least the court would at the time of sentencing make the determination that this person is going to lose their gun rights and put that into the record and inform the person so that they would know that they're not allowed to possess firearms without receiving, going through the process of receiving relief from the court. Because otherwise it'll create kind of that sticky situation of all these people being out there in limbo somewhere, wondering whether or not, not wondering, but then after the fact, getting popped for ex-con in possession, and then having to figure out after the fact whether or not the person falls within that definition or not. And again, that's the federal definition, but I don't think that the federal definition is contemplated for the same purposes as it's being used in this bill. So that would be the major change that I'd like to see in the bill, and that would probably also apply to pretrial release. The only thing we'd have to do is say that the court will have to make the determination and tell the person at the time of sentencing or the time of release hearing that we're taking your gun rights away, so don't go hunting. And I think that cleans it up.
Madam Chair?
Representative Mannix.
One friendly suggestion on how you might address this problem, and it is a problem as to equity in terms of misdemeanors involving violence, is to do on the misdemeanor conviction just what we've suggested be done on the civil commitment. That is, a judge could make a determination at the time of entry of the judgment of conviction that, in the judge's opinion, this was a misdemeanor involving violence, which would disqualify the person from possessing a firearm for the next 4 years. You could also make this prospective in effect so that we won't go back and grandfather in any prior convictions. From the effective date of this act onwards, a person who's convicted, there should be a notation as to whether or not, in the judge's opinion, this was a misdemeanor involving violence. He can check that off on the judgment. The defendant is then notified, well, all right, you've been convicted of a misdemeanor involving violence for the next 4 years. You may not possess a firearm. That is a way of dealing with it prospectively, and also I would add that this is a way of also, for people who are concerned about being able to possess firearms, making them perhaps be a little bit more law-abiding, worrying about getting involved in that kind of activity that's going to lead to that kind of a conviction.
I don't know, I'm not going to add to a lot of those things, but I did have some problems in the bill initially. Representative Mannix had put a section in the bill that said if you got one DUI, you're going to lose your gun rights forever. And I think we might talk seriously about sterilization or other things, or some people might talk seriously about that. But for an offense that has nothing to do with guns, it doesn't make sense. I guess it'd be great for the TV commercials, is how we talked about it in committee, that you got the ones that say you get a DUI, you're going to get thrown in jail, lose your driver's license, and you're going to lose your gun rights, so you can't go hunting. That might be part of what we'll see in the future. But I don't know if that's appropriate, so... Anyway, that's the major change that I think the bill needs badly. We would have probably tried to get to that in my subcommittee, but forces beyond my control elected to take that power out of my hands. The other section, just quickly, there were a bunch of little things, but this is the more important things. The other section that I have a concern about that I don't think was ever addressed, and the Ways and Means Committee did, I think, a great job of addressing a number of the concerns, is in section 17, I think it's in one other place in the bill also, page 18, line 33, when they use the language reasonable cause.
Did Ways and Means put that one in?
I don't know if they did or not. I don't know.
We're training.
No, I've lost it.
The Friendly Non-Substantive Ways and Means Committee. Yeah.
Right.
I don't. The only concern I have, and maybe some of the other lawyers that are more experienced on the committee than I will be able to dispel this concern of mine, but the reasonable cause language is something that I've never really seen in a criminal statute applying to police. Maybe if they have reasonable cause or probable cause, we have different levels. It's a civil standard, I think, and there needs to be intentional, knowingly, reckless, or criminal negligence. Some kind of a criminal intent standard in the statute there for it to make sense. We made a number of little blunders like that throughout the bill, but that's the one that comes up those are the only two changes I really want to bug the committee about, because those are two that I think are important.
I think the committee has ferreted them out, but we thank you for bringing them.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your concern. Senator Springer.
Well, I just want to make sure, if not tonight, and I see we're fading pretty fast here, I do want to make sure we have an opportunity to explore Section 38, just what it does or what it doesn't do. And I also, I guess the question of the effective date, this, I think, as written, would have the normal effective date. And I wonder if we ought to fix a time certain in the future, since we are changing the ground rules. It's going to affect law enforcement. I mean, if we had a date certain, and I, you know, January 1st or whatever, I think that would make it easier for everybody to learn to understand what this would all be about.
Especially if you're going to have judges make a note, make judgments on civil commitments of what they think about guns. And I think that's going to throw a little wrinkle that the judges are not really happy to make. So
I think that's an excellent suggestion about an effective date.
If I could, before I forget, that the same analysis might have of the misdemeanors involving violence might be applied to at least the DUI cases, so that a person at the time of sentencing is notified that you've just lost your gun rights until X date, if there's going to be something like that added to the bill. It might become kind of, there'd be a lot of confused people out there.
It'd have a great effect on drunk driving.
Sure. Pardon me.
Instead of these guys, being out hunting on the weekend, they'll just be out driving drunk on the roads, wishing they could be out hunting. I appreciate the committee's time.
Thank you very much. And we have people who are here on Section 36 and Section 5, and people who are here about liability, and people who are on Section 38. And it will likely be that we're going to take this up tomorrow afternoon. Sometime generally around 1:30, 2 o'clock probably.
Considering the House vote on the construction bill, we will probably have a couple more days.
Okay, thank you very much. We are in recess. We're adjourned for the evening.